Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Break It Pod podcast. Today we're here with Gary Files. Is it Files?
Yeah, Gary Files.
Gary Files. And, pardon?
Unusual surname.
No, it's cool, yeah, Files. I didn't know if it was like Phillies or something like that, but Files, okay.
Oh no, that's the Blackpool area, the Files region.
Is it? Oh, okay, very good. And today Gary is the director of a company called Thinking Bigger Limited. And it does everything. I mean, it does a lot of things. I think it's probably better if Gary explains what Thinking Bigger Limited is. And then after that, what his background is. He's got one hell of a background. So that might take up the majority of the podcast. But yes, Gary, take it away.
Yeah, thank you. That's quite an introduction there. Yeah. So Thinking Bigger, kind of just came out of nowhere, really. I started business in February. After I wrote a book a few years ago called Think Big Playroom, and when I had to create a company, it was going to lead from that, and so Thinking Bigger just seemed like the logical name for the company. And it came about because I was being asked to visit schools to talk about the book that I created in 2021, which I'll talk about a little bit more.
Absolutely.
I had to have a company to just be able to do that and arrange things through that, that way, you know, invoice schools, process payments, things like that. And around about the same time, I published my second book. So because I was self-publishing, I kind of ended up as an indie publisher to some extent. I say that, I mean, I'm literally just self-publishing my own work at present. But there's so much going on. Or Thinking Bigger seems to be Thinking Bigger seems to be quite a good name for the company, as it just seems to be growing quite a way. So there are other things, as you said, there are other things it encompasses, including coaching. I do a lot of coaching. So going into schools and I guess the visits that I do in schools is just group coaching, encouraging children to be better learners, more engaged learners, more engaged readers. And giving them self-belief. I do a lot about mindset, think, with this being a mindset podcast. That's why you've got me here. So Thinking Bigger just seems to be growing a little bit and potentially giving other people opportunities as well. So I'm working with other illustrators. I'm working with other writers. I'm coaching writers. I'm coaching people to become authors and believe in themselves and just
Thinking Bigger. Think Bigger. Yeah, Thinking Bigger. No, it's a brilliant name, and the company, you've got one hell of a resume. So where did you start out? You were a teacher, is that right?
Yeah, so that was my start, really. I kind of knew I wanted to be a teacher at quite a young age. I think when I went to my careers advice meeting secondary school, I walked in there and pretty boldly and just sat down and said, oh no, I'm gonna be a teacher.
Yeah.
And my dad presented to me a few years back with the piece of paper that he found from the careers advisor, saying that I was absolutely certain that I knew what I wanted to do. And the reason for it was I didn't want to make a rich person richer. I wanted to put into education what I got out. I had an amazing teacher who gave me so much self-belief. And I think that's really the core of it, you know. And so I went back into teaching. I taught for 20 years, taught in London for over a decade, and then taught in Vietnam for 6 years at an amazing school, considered one of the best in Asia. Mm-hmm. And the practices there, what the opportunities I was given were second to none. We worked with incredible CPD providers from King's College, London, from Cambridge University. We had people coming out, and the opportunities were given, fantastic. The head teacher was so encouraging and so trusting. His catchphrase was go for it, Gary. And I'd come in with an idea of something to do, and he just said that would be what his response was, go for it, Gary. The kids will love it. They'll love that. Yeah, go for it. And we were visited by Sir Guy Claxton, who talked to the school about a number of things, but one of those was independent learning.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went back to school, I asked Simon, the head teacher, if I could give it a go, if I could create a project, create something around the independent learning idea. And of course, go for it, Gary. Go for
it. Was he from Mancunian?
He was from Blackpool, actually. Maybe that was why he gave me the job, because he recognised his surname. He was brilliant. He was an amazing head teacher. You don't get many like him. And I was able to run an independent learning project from the school and through the school. And the response to it was incredible, by giving the children the choice of what they learn, by giving the children choice of how they do things. And the engagement just was incredible. And that was all on the back as well, with a lot of work on mindset, metacognition. The school was very forward thinking, as I said, and with all of that coming together, it kind of, what I'm doing now, and it just leads on from my work. I think schools in this country could actually look a lot more at the best practices of the world schools, because around the world there are some incredible schools, and what they're doing is remarkable. Students that they're turning out are going to be world leaders, and that's simply because they're so far ahead of other schools. It's not that the kids that we've got in this country haven't got the potential. It's just what we're doing with
that potential. Absolutely. Yeah. I went to Uganda with a charity, someone that I've known for a long time and has been a big sort of part of the last 10 years of my life, to look around and film and do some teaching in schools, only for a few days. It wasn't long. And yeah, I can't imagine we were given an unbiased group of students, but in terms of like interest and ambition, but the students that we spoke to were just absolutely amazing. Some of the things that they wanted to do, like these 14, 15 year olds just had plans and ambitions that far outweighed anything I'd ever seen in our secondary schools in here. And I've worked in schools now my entire adult life, pretty much, and which isn't obviously very long, but still. It was quite amazing to see. So yeah, there's a lot of, the Western school system is something that's a bit worried. I don't know what's going on. I think I also, the school I'm working in, sorry, I'm making it about me again, but I'm working in a primary school at the moment, and I was speaking to one of the TAs who has been in the same school for like 30 plus years, and she was like how the kids, they're just, not only are they so dysregulated nowadays, but they're so much more, talk back, I don't say arrogant, but they're so much more chat backy, and I just made that up, and they're just far less obedient, and it's quite hard to work out if that's a good thing or if it's a bad thing. And but yeah, I mean, I don't know, I haven't got enough experience, but it is interesting. Schools are really important, and you're right, we can take a lot from some of the best schools around the world and not demean them because they're not Western, which is actually maybe not a positive thing nowadays, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit a few points there. I think there are reasons for how disconnected students and generally just society in general are with schools. And I'm a bit of a conspiracy theorist, but my time in Vietnam allowed me to see propaganda in this country for what it is. And we've got to understand that all media output is propaganda.
So much.
You know, if it's censored and this is what we're allowed to see, then there's a reason for that. And when you look at the way that schools have been represented for, we're talking about, you know, since the 60s, you know, that there's an element of it's not cool to be clever.
Yeah.
The kids that mess around at school are the heroes. Teachers are the bad guys. You know, we're talking about all media output for kids, Beano, all the comics that kids read, the brain chill effect, you know, the sausage flying through the air with pork. You know, and I, even as a kid, I was watching that thinking it's amazing that this is the way that the TV in this country wants to represent schools and wants to represent children and intelligence. And the idea that it's, you know, that there's a massive disconnect between parents and teachers. And that wasn't the case in Vietnam because it was schools part of the community. And so, it was a very small community. It was very largely expats, but it was a small community. So if you went out with your family, you would bump into children, you would bump into parents. And you had to have a relationship where that was normal. And that used to be normal. That used to be normal in small schools in the UK. You know, if you went out and you bumped into your teacher, the teacher would chat to you for a while. You know, if in a very small school, you lived in the same village as your teacher. So you knew that person. And now it's very much because of safeguarding. One thing, but just a lack of trust. You know, that schools almost don't want teachers and parents talking, leaves them open to things, I suppose. You know, the world is a different place now, but there needs to be something that engages the trust in schools again. And we're not going to do that without that fit.
Yeah. You bring up propaganda. I've just watched the Barbie film a couple of days ago, and I'm actually sick to my stomach about what has been created in that, and just the fact that there aren't almost riots in the street just shows how, I mean, I just can't get over it. It's just, it was marketed as a kid's film that mums and dads could go and watch their 8-year-old, 9-year-old daughters to reminisce over, you know, an incredible franchise toy, and it's not that. It is a complete and utter piece of propaganda that Hollywood, as corrupt as it is, has just created. And it's quite shocking. So the West is, you know, I'm losing. I don't want to believe that there's a society that are running the world, and they have a plan for us, but I think that film was quite shocking, actually, how they just snuck in all these little innuendos about the so-called oppressive patriarchy, which, yeah, there's an oppressive element to society. There always has been and there always will be. You're not getting away from it, but it's not the whole story. So I just, yeah, and I think that is, and I reckon part of the reason why, this is my opinion, but I've spoken to people about this, reason why kids are so dysregulated nowadays is because, like, Joe Rogan talked about this really well. He said, you know, husbands and wives, like, it's hard for them to both have flourishing careers because who's looking after the kids? And what I worry is that the school is now taking, and what I see, not worry, it is actually happening, the school is now taking on more of a parental role than the parents, because the parents are so disconnected from one another. They're disconnected from the kids. They're busy at work. And it's like, and it means that the education system can swoop in and direct these children the way they want to be directed. And that is, I don't think that's happening. That literally is happening. I've seen it. I see it multiple times. I have seen it multiple times. And you're right. We've got to build, somehow create more connection between positive teachers and positive parenting, and not let the children of the West become, you know, become isolated and neglected, which I really think is happening to some degree. I don't know, that was a bit of a rant, and I'm sure not all of it is correct, and I don't really know what I'm talking about in a lot of ways, probably. But
thank you, Mr. Yourself. Yeah, I think you are talking absolute sense there. You know, that there is it, that teachers have to take a parental role, and that has happened more and more throughout my career, and it's not just in the UK.
There's
different levels of it in internationally as well. They call it affluent neglect, where kids are brought up by nannies and don't see their parents. I was witness to that on a number of occasions. But I'm heartbreaking. That is just much. But we've also created a society. I've got friends who talk about you know, one of the outcomes of the rise of equal rights is the fact that we've gone from a society where one breadwinner,
brilliant, this is exactly
family,
so
where it's now required for two breadwinners to not be able to
literally
sustain a family, and I am very political, so I hope I'm not going to take it down this road too much, but it's, you know, there is a massive imbalance in our society, and people that don't see how imbalanced it is, I've just got their eyes closed.
So
again, you know, what, living in Vietnam, I'm talking from a person who was in an incredibly affluent position living in Vietnam. I lived in a luxury home, a luxury. I was so fortunate. And every single day, I didn't feel, it never sat comfortably with me. And I knew it was temporary. I knew it was only as temporary as my stay there. But I would look around at friends, because I would make, you know, I would call them friends, these people that I met while I was out there, who were living in shacks, living in corrugated iron shacks. And I was the person in a home where, I was a teacher. I was a teacher that come from the UK. Really was there that reason for the imbalance, and my home doesn't nowhere near as luxury as some people. You know, we're talking about enormous villas that took up acres of land, and then someone else that works for them living in a corrugated iron shack. You know, the difference, the disparate vision that you have between these two lifestyles. And really, is there any good cause for it? Because most of that wealth, and in this country, most wealth is inherited. Most wealth is accumulated from wealth. There's more money made from money than there is from hard work. And that's the problem. When someone pays more tax on their hard work than pays on the money that they're making from having money.
That's
just wrong.
Yeah. No, I don't know what the inheritance tax is actually, the actual number is, but yes.
I heard something recently. It was like some nurse will pay 50% of their wages on tax and fees and people, you know, national insurance, everything else. It's about almost 50% of their wages. But,
wow.
Whereas someone earning money from capital earnings, it's 20%. So you pay less tax on money that's just making money than you pay for your hard work, and you're talking about, again, this is billionaires who don't need the money paying 20% tax, and a nurse who's saving lives and has paid a pittance, and say for a TA, a teaching assistant, has paid, you know, barely minimum wage. Teaching assistants, nurses, they're heroes, and we don't deserve it as a society. And any talk about, you know, it's necessary. I don't know. I know that there's a better way forward. You know, I heard a great quote the other day about how you wouldn't say that the latest car that's been made is going to be the best car that's ever made. And there's never going to be a better car that's made than this.
No,
because that's not how things work. Yeah, that's what we've done with capitalism. We've gone, okay, well, this is what we've got. and we're not going to change it. But there's a reason why we're not going to change it, because it benefits the people who are in charge. And then that comes down to where the problem is with schools, where they're not going to educate people enough to overthrow them. There is a reason that children and society are kept at a position they don't want people to be awakened. They don't want people to be aware that we can be more, or that there is a different way. You know, so the Romans did it thousands of years ago. Distract the masses with gladiatorial fights. Well, they had to move on from that. The gladiatorial fights weren't enough to distract people. So along came football. Then along came mobile phones. And then along came doom scrolling and laughing at fat guys falling over on the beach. You know, and we've gone to a lowest common denominator. You know, we've been through Love Island. We've been through Britain's Got Talent. And some people are still stuck there. Some people, and they're happy. They're happy because they're distracted. And as long as people are just scrolling through their phones, they're not going to be thinking about how to make money, or connecting with. And again, that's one reason why we're so disconnected, because the more we connect with each other, the more likely it is that someone, that we all realize that we don't think that what we're living in is right, because life is not meant to be at the 9-to-5 grind.
No, I agree. I agree.
I get on my horse.
No, it's got to challenge these things, question everything, but try and also be aware of the possible positives that a result, and then look beyond where we can make improvements and make change. That's what we all have to do. Talk to me about some of the...
That's exactly it. It's not about being negative. It's not about being solid, because I get called that, you know. By being someone, you can say, well, here's this situation. You know, I'm an analytical person. I know the thinkers are analytical people, so we tend to look at it. And it's not about being negative and saying, well, this isn't good enough. It's like anything. As a school, you reflect on your practice, and then you improve. And if you're not going to reflect on your practice, then you won't. And that's what we need to do as a society. We need to look at our society and reflect as a society and go, is this where we want to be? Do we want to be a society that are just plugged into devices, laughing at fairly meaningless videos? Well, no, I don't think we do. Do we want to be a society where there are homeless people and there are people with more money than they could spend in 10 lifetimes? Well, again, I'm not happy with that society. I think there is better. And I think we can do better. And that's where mindset comes in. You know, mindset, you have to have a positive mindset to live in this world that we live in without distracting yourself with a phone, because they're the options that you have.
Yeah. Have you heard of something called the Pareto distribution?
Pareto distribution? Go on, explain.
So there's a line in the Bible that says, to those who have everything, more will be given. And from those who have nothing, everything will be taken. And basically, and there's a thing called the Pareto distribution. And what it's basically the 80-20% rule. So, but it's even more exaggerated than that. It's more like 90-10 or 99-1%. And it's like this, it's like 99% of all songs ever released. 1% of all songs ever released get more views than the other 99% put together. And 99% of all the money is held within the hands of 1% of the population. It's all these things. It crops up everywhere in society. And it's kind of like, it's almost like a natural law. So we really are left to our own devices. Society does just sort of transgress into... a very few percentage of people have all of it. It's like a game of Monopoly. Like, you first of all, everyone starts off with nothing or the same, and then by the end, one person has everything and everyone else has nothing. So as a society, we need to somehow work out how we can, and you know, the success of society is often dependent on how the smaller the gap between the richest and the poorest, the bigger that gap gets, the more society is likely to fail. And this, you know, that's well documented. And there's a famous guy who said, the true judgment of society is how it looks after its least fortunate people. And we are at risk of, you know, like footballers are now getting, you know, the money in something like football is just astronomical. And I mean, I love football. And there's football is more than a sport. It's a metaphor for life in a lot of ways. You know, the act of achieving a goal, you know, do that. That's what we are. We're goal searching machines. But the money, I mean, Erling Haaland is the same age as me, getting paid £1 million a week, is just ridiculous.
I mean, there are arguments, you know, that their careers are short-lived. They don't necessarily always have something to fall back on. Their careers can be very short-lived. One injury and that's it. That 1 million a week is gone. They work extremely hard. I don't think the normal person on the street actually appreciates how hard it must be to be a footballer. You know, that it governs your life. It controls what you do, who you spend your time with, what you put in your body, how you treat yourself. And then the recent interview with Dele Alli just shows as well the pressures on these really young kids who have not had the chance to go out in life and experience things before being put in that situation. You know, this is it. As a 43-year-old, I'd still find it a challenge to do what they do on a daily basis, to go out and perform in front of tens of thousands of people. And then they get back in the changing rooms. And because of social media now, they get back in their changing rooms afterwards.
Yeah.
And they look at their phone and they've got abuse. They've got abuse from their own fans. And it's shocking. You know, I do agree that the money, I think that they're a scapegoat. I think that footballers are a scapegoat because they're being paid £1 million a week by somebody who can afford to pay them £1 million a week.
Yeah.
The fact that someone can afford to pay them £1 million a week and we're not pointing at that person and saying, hang on, how much have you got that is an investment that you're making money from doing, you know? Society again makes us look at the not particularly wealthy people so that we don't look at the people who really are. You know, we talk about 1% of people, and that is a very small number of people, and most of that is inherited. Well, some of it's in the hands of tech giants, so let's face it. And they're also a concern for our global, you know, whenever there's that much power in the hands of an unelected person. Which these people are, and they have the power over our media. They have the power over the decisions that our government make. They really do. You know, yeah. Bill Gates now is the person who decides what the WHO says. The WHO has now got papers in place to dictate what our government do. We've got big issues in this world. I realize we're supposed to talk about mindset.
Let's go back to the apocalypse is always upon us, isn't it? And it forever will be. Let's go back to what books, what's the content and the message behind some of the books that you've written?
So my first book was called Think Big Playroom, Just Try. And it was based on experiences I've had as a teacher, working with children who had so little self-esteem that they just wouldn't engage with work. You see it quite a bit. Children just refusing to do the work. They won't pick up their pencil, or in worst case scenarios, if they get hold of a rubber, they manage to rub out their entire work. You know, I've seen children who rub out almost as much as they write in a lesson, or put so little effort into it that, you know, just scribbled work. When you know that they can be better, you know that they can, and it's not them being a problem necessarily. It's that they don't have the self-belief. And I've worked with loads of children with that. And so I came up with a little playroom parable, as I call it, using the toys that my children themselves have.
So all the names of the characters were made up by my own kids. And it's just a story about a little puppy who thinks he can't be a musician, so he doesn't even try. And then eventually the other toys push out this object that he's never seen before. And upon investigation, he finds out that it's a music box and all he needs to do is turn a handle. And his lack of trying, his fear of failure, was the only thing preventing him from being a musician like all the rest of the toys. And essentially, I didn't realise while I was writing the book that it's, you know, it was almost a message for myself as well. While I was illustrating it, I was there talking to other illustrators about illustrating the book for me, because I didn't think my illustrations were going to be good enough, even though I'd already illustrated someone else's book before I made my own. You know, we all have that, and so that's what's been really powerful is realizing how it's not just a book for children, and so adults have been equally as inspired by it. And it kind of did nothing for a while. I went back to teaching, and just had the book out there. You know, it's not the best way of marketing, but and then when I left teaching in December, I pushed it a little bit more. I said some schools had picked up on it, and I was being asked to go to do author visits for around Book Week. And they went really well. It's kind of why I did it. The children back in Vietnam, I was teaching them about mindset. Mm-hmm. So that's where the story comes from. When I was in Vietnam, I was teaching children about growth mindset. Around about the same time, I was asked if I would illustrate my father-in-law's book. And I didn't think that my illustrations were going to be good enough. So I said no. Mm-hmm. And he kept on coming back to me, and I kept on saying no. And eventually I let slip to the class I was teaching the fact that I'd been asked to illustrate a book. And their response was what really, really awakened me. They said, "You're not allowed to say no. You're not allowed to say you're not good enough to be an illustrator, because you are. We love your pictures." Mm-hmm. And you won't allow us to say we can't do things. You yeah. won't let us as children put a limit on ourselves. So you're not allowed to do that either, Mr. Gary. I got me there. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
I went and illustrated the book. And then when that book was published, and there was a book in the British Library with my illustrations in, it did inspire me a little. I got copies of the book and put them in the library at the school, and they were instantly the most popular books. The children we'd have authors come and visit the school, and the children said to me, "Miss Gary, if you were to write stories," I did write stories with them. You know, teachers write stories with the class all the time. They said, "You know, your stories are brilliant. If you were an author, you'd be the best. You'd be the best one. Go and do it." And they encouraged me. And so I kind of made that plan before I moved back to the UK. I made the plan that was what was going to happen. I came back, wrote my first book during lockdowns. Between lockdowns, I was doing supply teaching. Work dried up because of lockdowns. Mm-hmm. So I just got on with the book that I'd had planned. I'd already written another one while I was in Vietnam, but that came out later. That's the one I released at the beginning of this year. The story itself is something that inspires other people. The fact that, you know, that honesty of saying we all feel like this, we can all feel this idea that we're not good enough, that we can't do it. And so taking that message into schools really helps, you know, gives them the idea that they can do something. And it all feeds off again, like from the independent learning that I was talking about earlier on. You know, we really have got the potential of doing so much more. And that message isn't given enough to certain children. Certain children in certain schools get told not to have limits. Yet other schools, we put limits on kids.
So. Yeah. Now, you there's a psychologist that I love called Jordan Peterson. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he, in one of his books, one of his rules is treat yourself like someone you love. And, you know, I'm not saying that you love the kids, but in a way you probably did. And the way you were telling them to have confidence and be courageous with their work, and then they reflected that back onto you. So effectively they helped you facilitate that process of you treating yourself the way that you would treat them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and actually, Andrew Huberman, I don't know if you know.
Yep.
He recently did a podcast about growth mindset, and he said the findings are that growth mindset works best when it's practiced not just by the children, mm-hmm. but by the teacher as well.
Wow.
And that was exactly where it was for us. You know, they reflected it back on me. I realized that I needed to have that growth mindset. And when you really do it, embrace growth mindset, it doesn't put limits on you. No. You know, and it really is about just believing that you can learn, just believing that you can get better at something is absolutely fundamental to getting better at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's three things that really underpin learning. The first one is a growth mindset. If you don't believe you can learn, then you won't learn. The second one is motivation. If you don't want to learn, you're not going to learn. I always said that as a teacher. You know, you can't make a child learn. You can motivate. You can try and motivate them. You can put information in front of them, but if they don't want to learn, then they're not going to learn. And the third one is more for adults, and that's ego. If you don't think that you need to learn, then you're not going to learn. If you don't actually engage in it because you see yourself above the information that's being presented to you, then those three things will limit your ability to develop.
And that's brilliant. And I would say that also applies to something like mental health and therapy, which is what we'll get onto next, because one of the prerequisites to engaging, or Carl Jung said, who was a famous psychoanalyst, said one of the prerequisites to engaging in therapy is the willingness to, what was the first one you said? Oh, you have a growth mindset. Or in other words, to be successful in therapy, you have to be willing to let go of your ego and allow your brain to stumble around your issues and find a new path and let things go and release thoughts that are trapping you. And you've got to be motivated to do that, because, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. It's the same concept. So that's really interesting. Those three things, when I look back, I'll write those three things down because they're really good. Let's talk about, have you had any issues with mental health? We talked a little bit about Dele Alli, who, by the way, is my absolute hero. I'm absolutely obsessed with him. I have been since he joined Spurs, since I was a little 15-year-old. I've got a thing, I've literally, everything I've ever owned has been called Dele. My first car was called Dele. I've named a chicken Dele. I've got a poster of him there. I know there's more things called Dele. It was slightly worrying. I mean, it wasn't worrying, maybe for a little bit, but yeah, he's brilliant. And you're right, that video was quite phenomenal. But yeah, what about any issues, any mental health? You know, what can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I've had issues throughout my life with depression. I think it's quite an interesting topic. There's different ways of looking at depression. You can either think it's like a chemical imbalance.
Yep.
Or one of the more interesting takes on it I've seen in recent times is the fact that it's not really depression. Again, I promise I won't go too political, but it's endemic of the society we live in.
Absolutely.
We are not creatures who are supposed to be living in a solitary life. Working 9 to 5 in a job that reduces us to a robotic output.
Yeah.
and then doesn't have the connection with the society around us. You know, if we were come back and collect around the fire, and there would be it would be a completely different situation. We would have, and I'm not saying that there wouldn't be emotions. There certainly would be, but depression is you can't look at someone who's depressed without looking at what the situation is. Amazingly, most people that I know that are depressed are also broke.
Yeah.
And are also in a crappy job or are going through a breakup. Yeah. You know, there are, if you look at the situation that someone's in, that's not depression. No. That is, life is getting you down. Yeah. And so for me, life has got me down on a number of occasions. Some of it was just my chemical imbalance. Some of it was my looking at society. There was periods of my life when I was younger going, really, is this as good as it gets? And having a bit, being in a bit of a lack of hope. Seeing myself through that. I separated from my wife while I was in Vietnam, and that was one of the most challenging things that I've been through. We have two kids. Mm-hmm. And so as a kid, my parents were divorced, and I'd always said that I wasn't going to allow that to happen to my kids. And so there was a lot of self-reflection that had to go on after that happened. And a lot of picking myself up. And that's where, again, mindset, neuroscience, for me, Buddhism, Stoic philosophy, there's lots of different things that feed into my ability to, my coping mechanisms now. And that makes me pretty unwaverable. And so now that was the last time I really had a dip. But again, I wouldn't call that depression. I'd gone through a breakup. I'd lost my kids. I was living in a place where I knew that I wasn't worthy of the affluence that I was afforded compared to the people around me who worked just as hard but had nothing to show for it. So the depression, it wasn't really depression. It was, wow, okay, how am I going to get through this?
Yeah.
So that's where mindset comes in. You know, one of my greatest things when it comes to mental health, and this is what, it can seem crass, but Buddhism teaches us that all suffering comes from wanting. That everything that we suffer, whenever we have pain, it's because we want something, apart from physical pain. You know, we're not cracked up or bruised or something like that, you know.
We want to be healed.
And it really is fundamentally true. You know, whenever there's suffering, it's because we want something. And it also teaches that gratitude is a way of finding inner peace.
Mm.
And neuroscience is catching up with it.
Yeah.
You know, for millennia, for thousands of years, these religions have been teaching us these things. And neuroscience is now catching up with it. And it's now known that the act of gratitude releases both dopamine and serotonin in the brain.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, isn't it? Yeah.
So the act of being grateful literally makes you happy. It can literally just change your brain. And it is almost quantum physics. You know, it's a case of, like when you look at a photon, you decide, are you going to look to see if that photon is a wave or a particle? You know, we choose what we look at. We choose what we see.
Mm.
And we also have that choice with gratitude almost. You can look at something and go, is this something I like or is it something I'm grateful for? And by making the choice of I'm grateful for this, you can put yourself in a constant position of peacefulness. So we can find gratitude in anything, you know. It seems crass because I've been in that situation. I was sleeping on someone's concrete floor for a while when I was registered homeless.
Yeah.
But I was still grateful for the fact that I had a roof over my head.
Yeah.
And I was able to get out of that situation. That was purely because of COVID. It was just, I moved back during COVID from Vietnam. And like many people, the situation in the country wasn't conducive to to people doing well, you know. But I was unwaverable because that knowledge of being grateful and you know, finding that inner peace work.
And 100%, there's two things that I'd like to say. It's a bit like a panic. When people that suffer from panic attacks, and they say breathe, don't they? They say practice breathing. There's no good practicing breathing when you're having a panic attack, because it's gone. You need to practice your breathing when you're calm, when everything is still, and then you can hone the skill then. So if a panic attack does come on, your threshold is now lower, or it's higher because you've been of your ability to tolerate, because you've been practicing your breathing when you were calm. Whereas and it's just like what you said, practicing gratitude when you're in a state of chaos and the world's falling around you. If you haven't practiced it before, it's going to be near impossible. You have to try and do it when you have to try and be grateful for the little things when everything seems okay, and you have to train your brain, you know, create those new neural pathways. And that's exactly what you've got to do. And the other thing, going back to depression, there's a study where they took two groups of people who were depressed, and one group, they told them, this is a chemical balance, there's nothing we can do, you're going to need to take medication to make yourself feel better. And then the other group, they told them, they either said it was a result of the environment, or they said something along the lines of, you have the power, you can. The outcome of the study was that the group who were told it's a chemical imbalance, even though some of the time it is, the group who were told it's a chemical imbalance did far worse off than the other group, because they had this, they just believed that it was out of their control. And when someone like Andrew Tate, who we won't talk about, who I in a lot of ways do not like at all, but he always says depression doesn't exist. And obviously that's a lie. Depression does exist. But what he means is, to him, he can't be depressed. And in other words, if you say I can't be depressed, if something doesn't exist, do you understand what I'm trying to get at? It's like...
So there's a few points there. There's the fact that we create our realities. You know, that's becoming more and more evident. And people take it to different extremes. I don't believe we're walking around in a computer.
Yeah, simulation.
Program. Yeah. You know, I think... But we do choose what we see. And by choosing what we believe creates all of the basis of the reality that we live in. So if someone believes that the government are doing a good job, then that's the world they live in. That's really the world they live in, as far as they're concerned. And they will be living in a completely different world to me.
They will see a different world, yeah.
And if you don't believe that you can be depressed, then you probably aren't going to be depressed. But part of that might come from that you've had a very fortunate life.
Absolutely.
You know, I don't think it's just about your mindset. I think that, as I said, you know, there's societal issues, but there's also mindset. And this is where I was quite inspired by the people I knew in Vietnam. You know, a woman living in a shack whose job was to fill up people's motorbikes with petrol out of plastic bottles that she kept in her house. You know, and she slept on a hammock, and workmen would just walk through her house to go and grab some bits out of it. But she was always smiling.
Mm-hmm.
She was always smiling. And I don't believe that that was anything other than mindset. If you can be in that situation and accept that life is what life is, and find that there's joy in other places, then there's a lot to do with mindset.
And try and minimize
that. Someone said a moment ago as well, that I wanted to respond to as well, because I'm trying to remember what it was now. No, don't mind.
What did I say? Let's think. I talked about the depression and the not Andrew Tate saying it doesn't exist, when obviously it does. I talked about the the study where they took two groups of people. One, they told them that depression was a result of a chemical imbalance and there's nothing we can do about it. You need to take this medication. And the other, they said, if you change these things, like in your life, you can sort your depression out. And just the knowledge that they had the capacity to change their brain meant that they were healed's the wrong word. They improved far, far more than the other group.
I remember what I was going to say now. Yeah. So you also said about how it's about practicing things in the downtime.
Yes.
If you're trying to utilize a skill, thought patterns in a time of crisis, then it's not going to be there. And what something that I've developed an understanding of is about habit. We are creatures of habit and our brains work on habit. Mm-hmm. So if you create a habit apparently takes between 10 to 21 days to form. So to train your brain to be automatically grateful takes between 10 to 21 days of active practice. That's what I went through during when I was in Vietnam, when my children were living in the UK. I was far away from them. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was miserable, and I had to go through so many different processes to sort myself out. But one of those was 10 to 21 days of going, no, you can be happy. You can be grateful. Look at what you've got. And I did that myself. I can promise it worked. So 10 to 21 days to form a habit. And that goes with lots of things, with learning behaviors, with routines, any form of habit. And again, that's why mindset is so important, because when you realize that we are creatures of habit, my realization and self-reflection that I went through while writing the book and thinking, I'm not good enough to be an illustrator. Well, that was a habitual thought pattern that I had had from when? From when, I don't know when that was created, but something had created that thought pattern. And we are a culmination of ideas about ourselves that have largely been created by other people.
Mm-hmm.
Someone wants, so my art teacher at GCSE told me my artwork was too cartoony. And I took that as, my artwork's not good enough, I'm going to give up doing art. So I didn't do art for A-levels. And then when I went back for my A-levels, all the art teachers were like, why are you not doing art?
Mm.
I was like, well, you told me it was too cartoony. So I'm now doing the science of it. So I allowed someone else's opinion of my artwork to put me off doing something, which then years later, it required other people to tell me, lots of other people to tell me, no, we love your artwork, you can do it. But it was only when I was going through that process and realizing that my habit of mind was to say it's not good enough that I could then change that habit of mind. That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Yeah, 100%.
And these are the confines that we put ourselves in. We think we can't do this. We can't do it. I'm not good enough to own my. I don't know how to run a business. I can't do that. Well, now I'm in a situation where I don't put those limits on myself.
Mm.
So. I created a business. I found myself saying, I need a website. I was about to pay someone to make a website for me. I can't make a web. Oh, hang on. Okay, then I'll make a website. Someone asked me if I would make an animation. I said, I can't make animation. Oh, hang on. And I made an animation. I started making animations for a company. And if I find my, that, obviously there are things I can't do. I'm not saying that I can, there's no chance I'm going to be a basketball player. I'm not tall enough and I'm rubbish. I can't be a footballer. I've never been good enough. But where did that come from? 10,000 hours. They send 10,000 hours to become an expert at something. If I'd have spent those 10,000 hours practicing football, would I have been good enough? Probably. But something put me off when I was young, and this is where growth mindset comes from. It's not that I am not a footballer. It's that I have not practiced that skill enough to be as good as other people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, habits is something that I actually don't know very much about, to be fair. There's the book Atomic Habits, isn't there, by someone who is very popular. So I should read more about that. Let's talk a bit about I think you touched on it briefly, but your childhood, what was that like? What was school like for you?
1980s school was quite different to school these days. I think there was something quite quaint and lovely about it. You know, at school at that time, Christianity was quite strong still, so we still had assemblies where we'd go in and sing hymns, and I think that there was something about that was quite good.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite good. It was you know, Christianity gets a bad press.
Definitely.
And I think that the teachings that are at the core of Christianity were what stuck out to me. So, you know, I remember singing songs about greed, about, you know, and all of these. It seems that the morals that are taught, you know, that we have the sins and we have the virtues, and the virtues that we sang about in hymns at school and we heard parables of, they were phased out towards the 90s, and something was lost there.
Absolutely.
So there was something quite pleasant about that. But at the same time, it wasn't an easy time. You know, schools in the 1980s, kids could be pretty brutal with one another. You know, stories of bullying were real. Stories of the way that we would treat each other were real.
Yeah.
I remember I got slapped by a teacher, even though it was already banned. I remember, you know, it was still the 1980s and stuff went on. It was, and I think I was a bit of an odd kid. Now I'd probably be diagnosed with some kind of level of neurodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going home one time and saying to my mum, I was given a stupid test today. Few kids were pulled out of class and we were asked to draw stick men and explain what we were doing, it was me and a couple of the other kids. Like, it was a stupid test. Like, I knew what they were doing, but clearly I wasn't stupid enough to be sent to a special school.
Yeah.
So I was just told to just get on. You know, the teachers knew that was Gary, that's who, you know, if I was sat staring out of the window, then that's what it was. You know, I had, so my parents had broken up. There was some childhood traumas there, already quite early on. As I said, my last teacher at school, he was amazing. He split people. Some people loved him, some people didn't. But he was a piano player, and he was always the one that organised like the school shows. And he put me as the lead character. I was Oliver and Oliver up there singing on the stage, and like, you know, from being a really shy kid, to being able to do that, it gave me so much inside, you know, an understanding of what bravery means. And so school was interesting. School was interesting, but certainly I think what comes out of it now as a salient point was just how things weren't diagnosed. And I don't necessarily think that was a bad thing. Because I think one of the messages we give people with very, very minor neurodiversities is that they're not normal. Mm. And actually, I benefited a lot from going through society being told I was normal.
Yeah.
There are aspects that could be made easier, for sure. You know, life isn't necessarily easy when there's things that I don't find as easy as other people that may be considered neurotypical, but then there are things that I find easier. I know that I'm far more empathetic than some of my neurotypical people. So who's to say what's good and what's bad? And who's to say what neurotypical is? You know, there are so many different ways of judging, so many different spectra that we could judge people on. And each of those is something to do with the way that our brain works. And personally, I think there's no such thing as a neurotypical person. I think there's no such thing as normal.
Yeah.
I think that there are a number of spectra that we could judge people on, and I don't think that you'd find bell curves.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the weighing up the balance between categories and the help that sometimes a box can facilitate, and also the fact that you are then put in a box and that can be detrimental, is a really difficult thing to lay up. But I completely agree with you. Growing up, going through the education system, not being treated any differently, and if you feel like you are on slightly neurodivergent, what do you say, neuroatypical? I should know the phrase, but I think that's a really interesting thing that you notice how there's benefits, there's real benefits to that. It's really good. And going back to the religion thing, I think that's really interesting, because 100% the stories and the wisdom that is that are buried within the religious stories are incredible. Like, there's just so much, you know, and they're like fractal, meaning that they exist on every level of exist, like they exist on a personal level, on a social level, on a national level. So yeah, you're right. But that sounds good. That's a shame about the RA level though. But I suppose it doesn't really matter, because look at where you are now. And maybe, you know, that's the thing about if you can try and make the best of things, you know, they say it's far easier to connect the dots back. It's like, if things end up in good, which they are for you now that you've got this thing, and it will just grow and grow and grow, everything that you thought was bad that happened in the past is actually a dot that led to where you are now. So it completely changes the whole, it's like a movie that where the you find out the twist at the end, and then the movie changes because you know what happens at the end.
You're spot on there. Like, you know, even the separation between myself and my ex in Vietnam, that had to happen for this to happen where I am now. I wouldn't be where I am now if other things hadn't led to it. So I'm always, again, and that's part of the life of gratitude is once you've gone through a difficult point, being grateful for it, because. And yes. Even while you're going through it, to be grateful for it, because this is going to make you stronger. This is going to give me an experience.
Yeah.
And that's where Buddhism also comes in, just being at peace, understanding that the universe will take you the right way if you do the right thing, if you're, you know, karma.
Yeah.
Karma and following the universe, being 100%. At one, meditation, it all helps.
Yeah, 100%. Right. Final question. And then after the final question, I will do a little ending, but don't leave the call because we'll chat for a bit afterwards. Right. So final question, what was your breaking point? Or maybe there's multiple, or maybe there's none. Maybe it's been a gradual change.
I think there's been a lot. I think there's been a lot of breaking points. As I said, challenges, something that I've embraced.
Yeah.
I think one of them would be moving to Vietnam, moving there and suddenly being given opportunities that I hadn't been given, being given the belief that I can be something more. I said, the head teacher out there, Simon, saying go for it on a regular basis, was great to be put back in that situation that you can be in as a child where a teacher is encouraging you. We don't, as adults, often get that encouragement.
Very true.
Coming back to the UK and realizing things were different, I had a bad experience at my last school in December. If that hadn't have happened, I wouldn't have started the business. There's so many little breaking points. I feel that there's going to be even more. You know, with thinking bigger, it's, as I said, I'm not putting a limitation on what I'll be doing. I've got friends that want me to go into politics. I'm not going to say I won't. I've got plans to expand the business, plans for it to be something that can reach out to far more people and help create like a social innovation almost, and help other people grow as well.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. Right. Thank you very
much.
Can
I plug my latest book as well?
Definitely. Plug everything.
So I'll send a picture if you want. You can put it up instead. But so that's my latest book.
Perfect.
And it really is, again, embodying the thinking bigger. This one's Aim High. Again, set back in the playroom with the same toys as before. But this time they're building a block of tower out, building blocks.
Nice.
And the tall lion thinks that they've got this covered, so they only build one that's so high. And then a little bit of teamwork and aspirational thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing they know,
wow,
the team have created them. And it's this idea that aspirational thinking is what we need to surpass low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, again, it's that message that I have when I go into schools. You know, don't put the limitation on yourself. Don't say this is all I'm going to do. And it's really, again, what I did with Thinking Big. You know, I when I said I was going to be an author, when I said that this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to do this. I had many people telling me, "Oh no, you can't do that. You know, it's too hard. You won't be able to do this." But I've shown that, you know, even if I'm not selling thousands and thousands of copies every day, my aspirational thinking has got me so far. So it's doing all right so far.
Yeah, keep at it 100%. No, that's brilliant. Thank you everyone for watching. This has been another episode of the Breaking Point Podcast with Gary Fee. Oh, flip, I forgot.
Files.
Gary Files. Okay, Gary Files. And I will put all his links in the description. And yes, thank you for watching, and I'll see you on the next one.